Hello, and welcome to season six of Librarians with Lattes. As ever, I'm your host, Amanda Lau, Outreach and Marketing Librarian here at the University Libraries at UAlbany. It's been a while, but we are back, and let me tell you, I'm super excited for this season and even more excited for today's guests. So let's get to it. Welcome UAlbany Professor Dr. P.D. Magnus and Scholarly Communications Librarian Emily Kilser. Thank you both so much for being here. I hope everyone's doing well this morning.
Yeah, well.
Good. Okay. So as is tradition, I must ask, what are you sipping on today? What is keeping you caffeinated or whatever have you?
Black coffee.
That will definitely do it. How about you, Emily?
Coffee as well, although I've just finished, so I won't be glugging while we talk.
That is okay. I mean, like, you got to stay hydrated while you're talking. I have a iced Carolina honey from Argo here on campus. Yes, I'm still drinking ice drinks, even though it's October. It only recently started getting chilly outside, and I will drink ice drinks throughout the winter. I do not care. So let's dive into today's conversation on open access. I know we've talked about it on this show before, but could you remind our listeners what open access is and why it's important, Emily?
Yeah, sure. So open access scholarship is a scholarship that is digital, online, free of charge, and free of most copyright and licensing restrictions. And open access is important because by making knowledge more available to a global audience, more people can gain access to critical research. They can use it and build upon it. That's why we're really excited to be celebrating open access this week.
So that kind of frames our discussion that we're going to have with Dr. Magnus. Dr. Magnus, did you have something you wanted to add?
I just wanted to say as a follow-up, it's important to distinguish the digital medium as a method of transmission from open access, which is a question of licensing. And they go together pretty well because open access material can be distributed at low cost if it's digital. But really, it's a different question because lots of people get tripped up about it because it's now the case that most academic journals are available online, but that doesn't make them open access. And similarly, it's possible, depending on how people are using the licenses, to write open access content that's meant to be consumed in hard copy format or in non-digital formats. So they go together in certain ways, but I think it's important conceptually to keep distinct the licensing question. Do people have to pay to use it? Can people trade it around freely? From the format question, digital versus paper.
Yeah, I think that's important, especially for our listeners who don't know as much on open access to know the distinction. So Emily, I know you have some questions for Dr. Magnus. Do you want to kick us off?
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Magnus, I know that, you know, we've worked with you in the past. You're an active practitioner in open scholarship and open practices. You know, we've helped make your work openly available in Scholars Archive. You use open educational resources in your teaching. And you're a member of the university's Open Access Implementation Committee. But I know that you mentioned that you have a recent open access book project, and I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about that and how you found and why you chose to work with the publisher that you did.
So this is an academic monograph that I published last year. It's titled Philosophy of Cover Songs. It's about the questions that arise in the philosophy of music. And I published it with Open Book Publishers, which is a nonprofit academic press that publishes everything. All of the books that they publish are published under open licenses. And although they use various licenses, they encourage authors to use the most open of licenses, so to make it as the material as freely available as possible. They were actually my first choice to publish the book with. It's a book that I wrote at the end of over the course of 2021. On fall 2021, I was on sabbatical, and I wrote the bulk of the book then. They were my first choice as a press because I wanted the book to be freely available. I wanted people to be able to read the book. And I think really, as scholars, that's really what we want at the end of the day. We want people to read. Of course, we want credit. We want whatever academic plaudits we can get for publishing the things, but we actually want people to read what we write. And I wrote a book a while back, which I published with a traditional publisher, and I'd had a terrible experience with it. So my motivation to publish open access this time was there were a number of factors, but one of the big factors was my experience with my previous book. So with the previous book, I'd published with a commercial publisher, which had a track record of being pretty good about making copies available at reasonable prices. But then immediately after I published with them, they were bought out by another commercial publisher. And as a result, the book that I wrote, which was not very long, was actually more expensive than it had been when it was first released. They did this thing of ratcheting up the price for the hard copy so that they could charge the same amount for the digital version that they used to have charged for the hard copy. And as a result, people weren't reading the book. People would cite it because they felt like it was a recent book on the topic. But it was clear from the way that they were citing it that they weren't engaging with the arguments that I made and the things that I wrote. So writing this book, it was really important to me that I not get locked in with a publisher that might, after I published with them, become a different publisher, right? I wanted the book to be freely available. And there's kind of a shift going on in academic publishing. There are, I think, a lot of publishers now are willing to publish open access books, but in lots of cases, they have to cover the expenses of publishing some other way. So the authors need to find a grant or need to find institutional money. And I didn't have any source of institutional money to pay for it being open access. So from the outset, I wanted a publisher where it was just presumed it was going to be open access. And I reached out to an author who had published with open book publishers previously, and he reported having a very good experience with their editorial group and with their editor and with their sort of whole process. And so so they were my first choice from the outset, and they expressed interest when I approached them before my sabbatical, as I started to think about the book project, and then accepted it once it was complete.
I just want to, I'm seeing like a parallel, and I hate to bring up like pop culture, but yeah, I think of Taylor Swift and how she had to re-record everything because, like, you know, they had access over her masters. And, you know, once you publish and it's not open, you kind of relinquish all control over what happens with your work, kind of in academic publishing. Like, it's not open, there goes all your control. So I think like another context, like it's like a parallel kind of thing. And it's interesting that you also publish on music.
It's definitely the case that it's partly about ownership, but there's this difference, at least with Taylor Swift. She wants to control her masters because then she gets control over the licensing. Whereas when I publish something open access, people can do whatever they want with it. I mean, there are certain limits. So the primary limit, given the license that was used for my book, is that they have to acknowledge me as the author. They can't republish my text and claim that they wrote it. But that's really it. So I'm not going to make money off of it directly. Open book publishers makes it available for free in certain formats. The PDF and the webpage version are free. And then they charge, I think, a perfectly reasonable price for hard copies and for the EPUB format. So it's available as a really nice paperback and as a hardcover fairly cheaply, but they get some money when people buy the hard copy. But I don't get anything when it sells as a hard copy. So there's no licensing value to me. The flip side of that, though, is because it's under an open license, if open book publishers were taken over by terrible managers and tried to do awful things with my book, I still am entirely free to do whatever I want with it. So I could see to making it available in other venues. I could look into, if it was important to me to have hard copies of it, I could have hard copies printed using other services. And that sort of freedom from the organization that I was publishing with, in case they went sideways, was an important factor to me in choosing open access for my book.
Yeah, that definitely that power as an author, I think, is important, especially when it comes to your scholarly activity, your work, something that you put in the time to do.
Yeah, so I think you brought up a couple things that I was curious in learning more about as well. So you mentioned the business model and that some publishers ask for grant, some open access publishers ask for grant funding to underwrite the cost of like the first copy costs for monograph publishing. And there is no book publishing fee at Open Book Publishers, which is really interesting. And it sounds like that doesn't, expectations of royalties wasn't something that influenced your decision making. Could you speak a little bit more about, you know, in addition to the idea of the business model as being attractive, and particularly as somebody in philosophy and the humanities, where there isn't a lot of grant funding to support publishing output and that sort of thing, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the constraints that you have working within the humanities and how that has sort of shaped your approach to open publishing.
I think, so going back, I don't know, 25 years, I would put drafts of my papers on my website and leave drafts. So I'd leave my author's final draft up once my papers were published somewhere. So this is a practice that's sometimes called green open access or green OA, where the author makes a version that's not the version formatted for a journal, not with the pagination and typesetting, but the same text as they submitted to the journal, available freely. I've been doing that basically my whole scholarly life. And then fast forward a few years later, in 2005, I wrote a logic textbook for AllX, an introduction to formal logic, which I wrote because the commercial textbooks were so expensive that I had students not buying the textbook and so failing the course in this sort of weird, irrational, terrible way that they'd paid for the course and for the units, but then they felt like they just couldn't afford the textbook so that they'd try to get by without it. And then like chaos and despair. So the motivation to write the book, right, for AllX back in 2005 was to have a book that I could offer to students for free. And once I was doing that, I thought it made sense to release on my website. And 2005 wasn't, I mean, Creative Commons licenses were not brand new at that time, but they were a pretty recent development. And when I released for AllX, a lot of people I talked to didn't have a category to understand open access. The closest analog people had was open source software. So lots of people called it an open source textbook. I think now, 18 years later, we have this category open access. It's, as a term, it's pretty widely understood, even if people don't necessarily understand how it works. So I released this textbook. Over the years, it's become a standard. It's been adopted dozens of places. Lots of people have taken it and made their own adapted versions. So perhaps the most widely used version of it now is made in Canada, which was based on a version that was made at Cambridge University in the UK, which was based on my version. So that because of the open license and the fact that it's an open education resource, people are able to adapt it to their needs and the courses that they're teaching. But it's kind of fun because my examples and my phrases and sort of bits from my original version survive in these subsequent versions. And so that project was, I think, possibly the most influential thing I've done. It's just a textbook, but there are people in philosophy who only have a vague sense of who I am, but they know I'm the guy who wrote that textbook. So people off outside of my specialty in other corners of the discipline who've heard of me because of that. And so that is kind of the other channel of influence, the fact that I've made things available and it's gone well. Like the history of sharing has been productive for me as an academic. So that positive experience paired with the negative experience of my previous book was the combination that made me want, or basically made me think I should only write a book this time if I could make it available open access. That was basically just a condition for doing it.
I'm a little curious. Since 18 years ago, I feel like the internet and online was a completely different place. So when did you start realizing that people were picking up your work from your website and adapting it, and it was becoming like a more widespread thing?
Well, almost immediately, I heard from people who were going to use it as a textbook in their own logic course. And in early years after that, I'd have to look exactly, but in the next couple of years after that, there was somebody who teaches computer science who adapted it because the part of the logic that's taught in philosophical logic courses overlaps with what with kind of discrete math and the things the computer scientists wanted to teach. So this is in the first several years afterwards. There was somebody who was teaching at a community college and wanted a lower level, like less advanced logic book. And so they took the advanced material from my book and combined it with material from another open access book to create a kind of hybrid text, which was their version. And he actually started a website for what he called his remix of For All X. For All X, the Lorain County remix, because it was Lorain County in Ohio. And I think that website still exists, although I'm not sure. But in any case, his version is still sort of live out on the internet.
That's really neat. That must have been a really cool, affirming like time just to see it spread.
Yeah, I continue to be amazed. It's now been translated into several languages. I believe Portuguese, Spanish, German, and Icelandic.
That's cool.
So there are editions which I don't like. I wouldn't have expected that. When it was just that I was writing it, and I thought there's no reason if I'm going to this effort that I should just keep it to myself. So I had no real expectation that it would take on the life that it's taken on.
I think about like if you went through traditional publishing methods, how much longer that would have taken to maybe get to the scope of, you know, where it is today.
So if we're talking about For All X, it wouldn't have achieved the scope, because part of the issue with logic books is that they're commodified. So lots of people have written logic books. There are certain things that I think mine does better than some others. Another part of the motivation was that I was unhappy with one of the chapters in the book I had been using, and I thought I was going to have to type up notes to help the students through the material to teach it the way I wanted to teach it. And then once I was doing that, it just sort of grew out to the thought that I could write a whole book. But if I'd written a commercial textbook, it would have sold for a while. It probably would have gone out of print. I mean, best I could have hoped for is that it would stay in print, but then it would just be yet another commercial textbook. It would never have taken on this life of having been adopted and adapted all over the place to different purposes.
Yeah. And you think of, you know, anytime you did want to update in a textbook, having to release a new edition that includes new materials, and it's a chance for a commercial publisher to increase the price because it's a new edition, and then it just goes on and on and on.
This is a point at which it's worth distinguishing the question of format from the question of license, though, because For All X was written to be a textbook. It has answers in the back. It has exercises. It has references at the end of the chapter. It's designed that you should flip around in it and work through problems and stuff. And that works best if you have it as a paper document. If you try to just have it on the screen on your laptop, it's harder to interact with. It's not a piece of software. There, I made it available on my website because that's what I could do to make it available to people for free. It's now the case that when I teach logic, I assign SUNY Press prints an edition. And that's the edition I use when I teach.
So you mentioned something earlier, which I loved, the idea of your work taking on a life. And oftentimes when we're talking with, you know, with authors or researchers, we talk about, you know, what is the life that you want for your work? And, you know, what's the goal of what it is that you're creating? And I think coupled with the idea of impact, and, you know, impact in the academy is critical to tenure and promotion. For a junior faculty member, you've gone through that process successfully. What would your advice be for a junior faculty member who is interested in making their work openly available, perhaps feel constrained by the what can be sort of limiting definition of what is impactful? How did you articulate the impact of your open work? And how would you recommend that others sort of engage with open practices, both to the benefit of their work, but to the benefit of their careers?
So I think it's complicated, and it depends on what kind of research product or scholarly product we're talking about. So in philosophy, it's quite common to get to tenure without writing a book. That's not true in all the humanities disciplines. And so the question of book licensing doesn't come up. And when it comes to what scholarly journals to publish in, I think it's a complicated question, because the prestige of scholarly journals, often the prestigious ones are the old ones, and the old ones are often traditional subscription licensed publications. And I think that's fine. So I talked earlier about Green OA. I think it's easy for junior scholars who are focused just on tenure to overlook the question of access. But it is now the case that there's no cost to sharing the author's final draft, to using Green OA as a way of making your research available to more people. I think there are some people that are hesitant about it because they want people to look at the published version in the journal. But I think they need to keep in mind, or what you need to keep in mind, is that the alternative to reading the Green OA version is often not bothering to read it at all. If I see an abstract for a paper or a title for a paper that sounds like it might have to do with something I care about, but I'm not really sure, if I have to jump through too many hoops to get a copy of it, I probably just won't read it. But if a Green OA version pops up as an early search hit on the internet, then I will read it. I will take a look. And if I decide I need to cite it, maybe I get the official version that has the page numbers. But maybe I just cite the whole article without the page numbers. And then, but in any case, I've read it and I've been exposed to that scholar's work. So I think taking advantage of Green OA is something that everybody ought to do. But there's no real barrier to junior scholars doing it. So that's one aspect, which is, and really that's thinking about journal articles. So for journal articles, I think it's a complicated question. I try to publish in open access journals when I can, but even regardless of whether I do or not, I make versions available on my website. And beyond my website, so this is just me thinking 25 years ago on my website, but now there's Scholars Archive. There are disciplinary archives for every discipline. So in philosophy, there's the Phil Papers Archive. In philosophy of science, there's the Philosophy of Science Archive, the Phil Sci Archive. And for whatever discipline people are working in, there are archives that will take the author's last draft, the Word document or the PDF, make it a PDF, but we'll take the PDF of the thing that eventually gets published. And now with open access policies, like the one we have at UAlbany, there's legal permission for the author to do that immediately. I think really there are no consequences to doing it immediately anyway. So my personal approach, and I think this is just the best approach, is to do it presumptively. Share as much as you can, and maybe someone will read it. The worst case is that no one reads it, which is where it's going to be at if you lock it away in a controlled access closed journal anyway. So that's journal articles. Sorry, I'm breaking this into cases and it sort of spirals out of control. But that's journal articles. For educational resources, for class resources, for teaching material, I think it makes sense to release it as open education resources or OER, because when it comes to tenure and promotion, nobody gets credit for having published a textbook. If you publish a textbook with a commercial publisher, you might make some money. That's actually one of the corners of academic writing where there's money for the author, is textbook sales. But if you're thinking about credit for tenure or promotion, education resources don't get you anything. You get to tell, you have to tell a narrative in which you're concerned about teaching and you're making efforts to teach your students. And open education resources are actually a better part of that narrative than a commercial textbook, because it shows that you actually want to benefit the community. And also it avoids the problem that lots of institutions have restrictions on whether authors can assign textbooks they profit from. And so they have to give profits back, or they have to make cut a special deal for the students. If they're not making any money, they don't have to worry about it. They can just assign the textbook, use it as a text in their course. And at the end of the day, I'm paid to teach courses anyway. I don't need to chisel students for a little extra money on the textbook end of that. So for education resources, I think releasing them as open education resources makes a lot of sense. It's always been the case that some professors have written their own textbooks or written their own modules or written their own material. And there's just the extra step of sharing it, putting the license on it and sharing it. So in the cases, I've split it from journal articles where people should be practicing Green OA, education resources where they should be releasing things as OER. And then we get to scholarly books. And for faculty who aren't promoted yet, who are writing a scholarly book, I'll concede prestige of the publisher matters. But even among prestigious publishers, you can distinguish the ones that are going to make the text more widely available from those that aren't. And when you enter into negotiation with a publisher, legitimate questions include, how much is this thing going to cost? When is the paperback going to get released? Or will it be released as a paperback? And I think we're also in the midst of a shift where traditional publishers are more open to publishing open access. That said, at the end of the day, if a junior scholar publishes a closed access text, or a closed access monograph because they're doing it with a prestigious publisher, I think I totally understand that trade-off. My ability to choose the publisher I wanted for the purpose of making the text available was partly because I was writing as a full professor. I don't need to impress people anymore. That said, I do want to, you haven't asked, but I do want to comment on my experience with open book publishers. One concern about open access presses is the thought that they're just vanity presses, that they'll just print anything. And I actually found the review process and the editorial process at open book publishers to be more rigorous than it had been with my previous book. So with my previous book, with a respected commercial publisher, the reviewers of the book actually didn't give me any substantive feedback. They decided to publish the book, but I didn't get any feedback on improving it or help improving it over the course of the editorial process. From open book publishers, there were two reviewers, both of whom had substantive comments, which were all couched in the form of, well, the author doesn't have to make changes, but if they did, maybe they should think about. And some of those comments I ignored because I thought they were wrong. But lots of those comments were really helpful. And so I think the book is a much better book for having gone through that process. And then in copy editing, the copy editing at OPP was also great. This is a point of subtlety. There's jargon, there are details, there's this flow of the argument. And it's easy for a copy editor who gets caught on individual sentences to not see how things fit together. And so then you end up having to argue with copy editors that you really should use jargon there or you should use a particular phrase there rather than something they think would be more euphonious or that they think would be more grammatically correct. I didn't really have that. That is, the copy editor at OBP was great. They really sort of saw the flow of the argument. And it's not that they were a professional philosopher. There were things they didn't get, but I think they were really helpful in yielding a clearer, better written text than there would have been otherwise. And that's working with an open access publisher. So the quality of the publisher, that's a separate switch from what license they're using.
I think that's a very important distinction to make, because I do feel like there's a lot of things that people have to say about open access anything, journals, books, publishers, whatever you want to say, like, there's a lesser quality there. And I can concur that my experience with an open journal was a lot different than my experience with something that was behind a paywall. The process was faster. It was a double blind review for this open journal, and they were more responsive. I'm not going to name names for these journals. Libraryland is a small world. We only have so many journals and whatnot. But it was completely night and day between the two. The timelines were different. The responsiveness, the care for the author was different. Not to say that there aren't paywalled, journal publishers that offer the same kind of level of care to their authors, but yeah, it was a completely different experience.
No, and it's interesting too to hear that the level of peer review you found to be sort of more refined as well. I was wondering if, in addition to talking about the peer review and the copy editing, if there were other specifics that you navigated with open book publishers that you found to be either that you found difficult or that you found to be demonstrably different than previous book publishing experiences. So for example, with the licensing, like, did you have a Was there sort of a, could you pick from any of the Creative Commons licenses? Was there sort of a, you know, was that a conversation or was it just sort of assumed that you would publish under, you know, whatever license it was that you chose for the work? And then another thing that I think about, and this is probably from our perspective within the library, we think about preservation. And at the start, you mentioned, you know, the publisher, the commercial publisher that you had been working with was absorbed by another commercial publisher and, you know, the shift in pricing and that sort of thing as a result. With open book publishers, they've been around since 2008, so they aren't brand new, but, you know, lots of open, it has been the case that open initiatives, you know, business models may or may not be as stable as a commercial entity, and even commercial entity are sort of, you know, subject to the vagaries of the environment in which they operate. So when you chose open book publishers, is that something that you sort of had in the back of your head, or are you, because of the open licensing and you still retain copyright to the work and you can, you know, put it somewhere else if need be, is that something, I don't know, could you speak to that a little bit as well? That
sure.
Was a lot of questions, sorry.
Let me start with the last question because it's the one I remember. If you want to circle back to something I've missed, feel free to say so. I think it's not clear to me that open enterprises are more likely to fail than commercial enterprises or paywalled enterprises. I think new journals or new publishing enterprises are likely to fail. And all of the venerable old models are paywalled commercial, or not necessarily commercial, because some of them are like university presses, non-profit, but all of them are paywall models because at some point that was all that existed. So over the last 20 years, most open access ventures have been new journals or new publishers. And of course, most of them are going to fail because most new enterprises fail. That said, and as you point out, open book publishers has been around a while, but to me, the open license gave extra insurance. That is, even if they just went under shortly afterwards and their website went dark and they stopped making it available, I can do whatever I want with this. The fact that I have the copyright and the fact that it's under an open license means that I don't even have to wait. If I just find that they're being jerks about distribution, like even if they continue to exist as an enterprise, but I just don't like what they're doing to make my book available, I can do whatever I want with it. I could make print-on-demand versions available. I could have handwritten versions by scribes in some exotic monastery made. I can do whatever I want with it, right? That project does not sound viable to me, by the way. That's not an actual project I'm suggesting for anyone. But like, if I want to do something with it, I can do it. And so I knew that my ability to do whatever I wanted with the text didn't hang on them as an enterprise. But that said, having published with them both allows me to say on my CV that I'm published with a publisher. It's not just a book I wrote on sabbatical and then dropped on my website. But it also increases the reach of it. I think there are people who read it who wouldn't have read my homespun thoughts about cover songs that I just put on my blog. So this is a tangent, but let me mention it. About reach. So turns out this fall, there's a music professor at a liberal arts college in Texas who is teaching a freshman seminar about cover songs. And the course text is my book, A Philosophy of Cover Songs. I can't imagine that would happen if it had been a $90 monograph with a typical academic publisher. Because most academic publishers, even if they end up offering cheaper versions later, the academic monographs start out pretty expensive because they want to chisel the libraries. And I can't imagine that he would have had a class of freshmen all buy the expensive monograph. Probably he wouldn't have even looked at the expensive monograph. He would have said, oh, that sounds interesting, and gone on and done other things. But because it was under an open license, he looked at it. And because he could make it available to students, and I don't know if he had them buy a hard copy, like if he had them buy a paperback, which he might have done. The paperback is under $20. Or maybe they're just reading the online version. But in any case, it's the course text. And so he's going to have me come in and via Zoom, I'm going to visit the class and join for a Q&A with the students. That's an opportunity. That's a sort of a reach my text has that I don't think it would have had if I'd published with a different publisher.
Yeah. Like, what are the odds? Like, that's what I'm like thinking. That's because I'm also thinking too, like, like you probably have an understanding of like what is out there like on that subject, like how many other texts are there that they would have had to choose from beyond yours? Like how big
well,
is that?
To be fair, there isn't another book on the philosophy of cover songs.
But still, now these students aren't forced to pay like $90 for like.
Right. And also, but I mean, probably he wouldn't have taught this freshman seminar. He would have taught a freshman seminar on something else if he'd had a different book. So, I mean, it may be that the existence of my book nudged him to make that the topic for the seminar.
Yeah. That's a really cool thing. I mean, you know. Plus, it sounds like a course I'd want to take. Like, that sounds like a really neat course. And I kind of now want to read your book, too, because, one, I love cover songs. Sometimes they're better than the originals. So, yeah, that's really neat.
Yeah, so if you want to read the book, it is available open access, in case you hadn't picked up on that.
I love a good marketing moment. So, you know, if you want to tell people where they can find your book online, too, go for it.
Yeah. If you search the internet for A Philosophy of Cover Songs, it will pop up as the first hits. So
good to know. I digress, though. So I know there was a lot to Emily's question. So
I think there were, yeah, there were other questions I don't think I answered. If you want to circle back.
It's okay. It was a tangled question. I apologize. My brain sort of went down a rabbit hole. I was also wondering, though, about if you could speak a little bit about the decision making on licensing. Was that a conversation that you had with open book publishers, or is it left to the author's discretion?
So regarding this monograph, I settled on Creative Commons attribution license. So the only requirement on reuse of the text is that people acknowledge me as having written it. That said, and open book publishers encourages the attribution license as the most permissive Creative Commons license, but they're willing to let authors adopt more restrictive ones. So I don't know, this may be things your listeners are familiar with, but other possible restrictions include forbidding commercial reuse. So as it is, people could publish my book and charge money for it, and that would be permitted under the license. And I guess if they want to, whatever. So I could have prohibited that. I could have made it a non-commercial license. And a further possible restriction is no derivatives. So to forbid derivative use, derivative works. And by not putting those restrictions on it, if someone wants to use a piece of my book as a piece of something they're doing, so say they're putting together a collection and they want to use a chapter from my book or selections from my book, they can do so. Or suppose they're putting something together that for other licensing reasons has a commercial component to it, they can use pieces of my book in the course of that to create something new. And I want to allow for those possibilities. And so I was happy to use that as the license. But open book publishers would have gone along if I'd wanted to use a more restrictive license. I guess another possible restriction, which Creative Commons allows, is a share alike restriction, so that people can create things that they paywall and put under full copyright that are derivative of my book, that use parts of my book or aspects of my book. And when I wrote For All X, so the logic textbook that I wrote 18 years ago, I originally had it under a more restrictive license. It was under an attribution, non-commercial, share-alike license. And I slowly dropped pieces from that so that the current version of For All X is only under an attribution license. And the reason I did that, I dropped the non-commercial part because it was unclear to people whether they could sell parts. So if they could take it to a copy center, which then sold copies of it, and the instructor who was teaching the course didn't make any money, but the copy center made whatever profit they make on printing copies, making printouts. I wanted to explicitly allow that because that's the way I used the book. This is in the dark ages. It used to be the case that copy centers would print course packets, which were custom printed hard copies for courses. Now that would be handled electronically. That's not necessarily an improvement for a lot of text, I think. But in any case, I printed it as a course, had it printed as a course packet, and I wanted other people to similarly be able to do that without wondering whether they were violating the non-commercial provision. So I dropped the non-commercial constraint. And then as people wanted to remix it, as people wanted to remix it and put it in with other texts which were under more open licenses that didn't have the same restrictions, didn't mix well with the share-alike restriction. Because the share-alike restriction said that if you put it into a derivative work, the derivative work has to be under a license that's just as restrictive or permissive as the one that you'd taken from my text. And so it limited the remix value. It limited the ability to take it and combine it with other open licensed things. And so for all X, I dropped extra restrictions over the course of years and was down to just the attribution requirement. And I'd sort of gone through that process slowly so that by the time I was writing A Philosophy of Cover Songs, I had concluded that really an attribution license is the most sensible choice because I don't know what people will do with the book. And it's not a textbook in the same way that For All X is. So I don't think people will adapt it for their own courses and rewrite it and remix it to the same degree. But I don't know. Like, I'd be happy for people to find amazing things to do with it. And I don't want to limit in advance what options they have. Because, so at the end of the day, and I realize that for some academic authors, this isn't the case, but I'm a professor. I have a full-time job. I teach. I do research. I do academic service. I get paid. I can afford a life. I don't need for this book to scout out a little extra supplementary income for me. If I have a choice between it making me any money at all and somebody else reading it, I'll pick somebody else reading it every time. And I think that's, so that's true, I think, for tenured and tenure track faculty in general. Like, we have jobs. And so the thing to keep in mind is really any money we could get out of that is a trade-off if it involves restricting who can actually see it.
I think it's that, what hill do you want to die on? Like, do you want the greatest amount of access and people to actually read your work, or do you want the money, however little might come from that? Like, I think about royalties for certain things. Like, that could be like cents on the dollar. Like, so
yeah, I mean, and the fact that royalties are almost nothing anyway.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's just like, what would you prefer? People actually have something to relate to your name, your good name out there, and know that you're the expert on, you know, X, Y, and Z, and get that knowledge, or get that little bit of money at the end of the day that might not be that much anyway. So I think that's important to think about. So we talked a lot about some of the legal things that have to do with, like, open access or getting there and publishing. So Emily, can you speak to, if you are a member of the faculty or someone who is interested in open access on our campus, where can they go to get some help? Because this is a lot of stuff to navigate. And if they're not at our institution, are there other places they can go to get help for this kind of stuff?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So if you are on campus, you can go to the library's services page, to the library scholarly communication services page. And there you will find a catalog of the resources and support that we make available to the university community. And that includes information on the open access policy, copyright and author rights, data services, Scholars Archive, and on and on. So go to the library website. That's our one-stop shop. For people not at UAlbany, there are several, I could recommend resources on resources for sort of getting an understanding of open access. I think a good text to start with would be Peter Suger's Open Access, which is published by MIT Press. It's openly available. For authors that are interested in learning more about author rights, there's a great organization called Authors Alliance. They provide resources and information about negotiating publishing agreements, about understanding open access, and that sort of thing. They're doing a lot of amazing work. Dr. Magnus spoke about Creative Commons licensing. So they have a great website where you can learn about the different licenses that people can apply to their work and sort of disentangle what that means. So I'd also recommend that.
And I will make sure that I link all of these resources, including Dr. Magnus's book, in our description of this episode. So make sure to go and click those and check out more on that. Last thoughts on open access.
So I haven't even talked in this discussion about another thing which I made available as an open access product, which is a deck of illustrated playing cards that you can play different games with. I haven't mentioned it because it's not an academic product. It's just something I generated as part of my hobby as somebody who plays board games and card games. And that project ended up being similar to the experience with For All X. It just got picked up, and there are games that have been designed to play with that deck of cards by people around the world. So some of the projects which I, in my life, which have been most successful and which I'm most proud of are open access projects. And the success they've had, the connections they've made between me here in Albany and people I never would have known otherwise out on the other end of the internet. Really, that's only been possible because I adopted an open access license and because I was willing to share. So I think as scholars, that's what we want to have happen. And of course, not everything I've released, not everything I've made available free has done wonders and been picked up. But I think it's been amazing to me how many people I've connected with and the kinds of experiences I've gotten to have as a result of making things available under open access licenses. So I encourage listeners to do it, and I hope they will be similarly amazed.
Awesome. And Emily, I kind of know where you stand on open access, but what are some of your thoughts, last thoughts on open access?
Well, I think, you know, I couldn't have pulled it all together any better. You know, the theme this year for Open Access Week is community over commercialization, and that idea of the life of your work and the idea that sharing is caring, and you're building a community around ideas. And isn't that why we're here? I just encourage folks to, like you said, to engage with these ideas, to check out Dr. Magnus's work. Yeah, get in touch with the scholarly communications team if you have any questions.
Awesome. So one way that we love to end this podcast is by asking our guests what they are reading lately. I know it's cliche, but we are a library and we read over here. So what are you reading, whether it be for pleasure or research? And we'll start with you, Dr. Magnus.
I've been reading John Dewey's Human Nature and Conduct because I've been in a reading group that's actually being held in Illinois. And via Zoom, I've been sitting in on this reading group and it's been really great.
Awesome. And what about you, Emily?
I'm actually listening. I have a long commute, so I do audiobooks, and I have young children, so I don't really have time to read physical books, which makes me sad, but I've taken to listening to books, and I'm listening to You Could Make This Place Beautiful by Maggie Smith. She's one of my favorite poets, and I'm enjoying reading her autobiography.
Sounds so pleasant. And of course, as everyone knows, I'm super spooky and I love October. Chuck Wendig just came out with a new book at the end of September called Black River Orchard. It's about evil apples and and orchards and cults. And it's just spooky and awesome. If you love that kind of thing, definitely check it out. So thank you both again for joining us today. It's been a pleasure. To all our Librarians with Lattes listeners, thank you for sticking with us. As always, I'm Amanda Lau. I'll catch you next time. And if you haven't been to the libraries lately, what are you waiting for? We hope to see you soon.